patience. "But some of us have higher ambitions for Lothal."
Orinda snorted under her breath. Ambitions for a backwater dirtball like Lothal? Right.
Good luck with that one.
"I'm serious," Uvis insisted. "Now that we have a Dunium vein..."
"We have a Dunium vein?"
Orinda cut him off.
"Price mining. Not you, and not Lothal. We have it."
"Fine," Uvis said. "Just remember the governor's office and I are included in that we. We're your partners, remember?"
"Not for long," Orinda said. "As soon as the profits from the Dunium start rolling in, we're buying out of your loan. We can do that. The contract says so."
"The contract didn't anticipate something like this."
Uvis took a deep breath.
"Look, Orinda, here's the reality. Yes, you've got wealth now, more than you ever dreamed of. That means it's your big chance. Not just Price Mining's, but yours, personally, as well."
"Really?"
Orinda said, trying to make the word sarcastic, but she couldn't quite pull it off. Because he was right. This kind of sudden wealth might finally make it possible for her to get out of here. Not just out of the family business, but off Lothal completely.
"But it's also going to attract attention, and not necessarily the good kind,"
Uvis continued.
"You need..."
He broke off as a hammer-headed Ithorian appeared around the corner and hurried past them, a stack of data cards in her hand. Someone's niece, Orinda vaguely remembered, working a 2-week internship. The Ithorian grunted a good morning, then disappeared around a different corner.
"You need support," Uvis said. "More than that, you need protection. Governor Azadi can give you that."
The nebulous thought of finally getting off Lothal vanished in a sudden cloud of suspicion.
"Protection?"
she countered.
"Or do you mean takeover?"
"No, of course not,"
Uvis protested.
"Really?" Orinda said. "Because we've heard this before. Other people have come to Lothal, lots of them, looking for ways to lift us up out of the dust and coincidentally make themselves rich. Sooner or later, they all find out that the people here are stubborn, set in their ways, and not interested in having fancy hats from the Corps tell them what to do."
"I'm glad Lothal has come to terms with mediocrity," Uvis ground out.
"But that pattern is over. The fancy hats will be coming back. This time to stay. And they'll eat small fish like Price Mining for breakfast." "Don't threaten me, Uvis," she warned.
"I'm not threatening you," he said. "I'm trying to tell you that everything's about to change. There are a dozen ways a big mining corporation can move in on a small operation like yours and either take it over or bleed it dry. I don't want that, you don't want that, and Governor Azadi most definitely doesn't want that."
With an effort, Orinda got a fresh grip on her temper. So Uvis had already told Azadi about the Dunium?
Damn. In a tight-knit community like Capital City, that meant half the citizens knew by now.
And if half the citizens knew, a good quarter of the outsiders in the area probably knew too.
"I assume you have a solution to offer?"
"We do," Uvis assured her. "We start with you selling the governor another 21% of Price Mining. That would..."
"What?"
Orinda demanded, feeling her jaw drop.
"Absolutely not. You're not getting a controlling interest."
"It's the only way to keep some predatory megacorporation off your back," Uvis said. "With the power and office of the governor protecting you, we can make deals with real refineries, the kind with money and influence."
"No,"
Arinda said flatly. Uvis took a deep breath.
Yeah, I know this is a big step, he said, his tone soothing now. But it's the only way.
I said no, Arinda repeated.
You need to at least tell your parents about the governor's offer,
Uvis persisted.
At least your mother, as the general manager, she needs to know.
Which part of no is confusing you?
Uvis's face darkened.
If you don't, I will.
No. What you'll do is get out of my sight,
Arinda told him.
Actually, what you can do is get off our property.
He snorted.
Please. I own 30% of Price Mining. You can't just throw me out.
The Price family owns 70%,
Arinda countered.
And the guard droids answer to us.
For a long moment, they stared at each other. Then Uvis inclined his head.
Very well, Ms. Price, he said. But hear this. You can sit on your dirty little world, a big frog in a small dust puddle, and think you can stand alone against the galaxy. But you can't. The sooner you realize that, the less it'll cost you.
He raised his eyebrows.
And your parents.
Goodbye, Mr. Uvis,
Arinda said.
Goodbye, Ms. Price, he said. Call me when you're ready to see reason.
Uvis himself was gone, but the cloud he'd left over Arinda persisted. A dozen times that day, she thought about going to her mother and letting her know about Uvis's warning and offer. But each time she decided not to. The mine had been in her family almost all the way back to the first planetary settlements, and she knew that both her parents would go down fighting rather than give it up. They had full legal rights to the mine, the land, and the business. Moreover, the Lothal legal system, where any challenges would be heard, was loaded with acquaintances, suppliers, clients, friends, and friends of friends. The one advantage of living on a sleepy frontier world. Whatever corporations or slicksters or sleazy grubbers from the governor's office tried to throw at them, they would weather the storm. She worked late, finishing up the day's data sorting and drafting a data release for whenever her parents decided to announce the news. Just because half of Lothal probably knew by now didn't mean they wouldn't eventually have to say something official. It was nearly sundown when she finally left the office. She headed for home, driving slower than usual, watching the colors in the western sky and the fading light as it bounced sparkles off the shrubs and intricate rock formations lining the roadway. On the horizon, the lights of capital city's buildings were coming on, a softer and whiter glow than the reds and pinks of the setting sun. From somewhere in the distance came the happy shrieking of children at play. Off on the horizon, she could see a pair of airspeeders, probably with teenagers at the controls, showboating over the rolling, grass-covered hills as they chased the setting sun. It was the kind of primitive beauty that travel advisors raved about. Arinda hated it. That hadn't always been the case. For a while, back when she was a child, she'd loved the quiet life, the wide open spaces, and the companionship of children of so many different species and backgrounds. But during her teen years, she'd begun to see the quietness as dullness, the open spaces as lack of culture or excitement, the familiar acquaintances as stifling and boring. Often lying awake in bed, she'd gaze out the window at the stars and wished with all her heart that she could escape to a real world somewhere, a place with excitement and bright lights and sophisticated people. But she never had. And with the passing of her teen years and her transition to the responsibilities of adulthood, she knew she never would. The pain and frustration had subsided somewhat over the last decade, but they had never entirely disappeared. She still hated her life here. But it was a familiar, constant hatred, like a dull ache that had never quite healed. She slowed the land speeder a little more, watching the interplay of city light and sunset glow. In worlds with excitement and bright lights, she suspected, many of the inhabitants never even saw the horizon, let alone a sunset. Of course, they probably didn't care about such things. If she were there, she doubted she would care either. Could Uvis have been right about the Dunium deposits being her chance to finally escape? She snorted. Of course not. That whole pitch had been a mind game, designed to distract her from his attempt to talk his way into controlling the company. Let him try. She didn't especially like her life here, but it was her life, and Price Mining was her company. And she would see Uvis in hell before she would let anyone steal it. The last wisps of color had faded away, and she was pulling her land speeder into her garage when her comm chimed. She glanced at the ID. It was her father, and keyed it on.
"Hello, father," she greeted him. "What's up?"
"Arinda, you need to get to the police station right away,"
Talmor Price said, his voice nearly unrecognizable.
"Your mother's been arrested."
Arinda stared. "What?
What in the world for? And who ordered it?"
"The complaint came from the governor's office,"
Talmor said, his breath coming in short spurts.
"The charge is embezzlement."
Talmor Price had worked in the family mine all his life, and Arinda had seen him act calmly and decisively in dozens of crisis situations. But this crisis wasn't mine-based, and for once, he clearly had no idea what to do. The police didn't seem to know what to do either. Talmor and Arinda were on a first-name basis with several of them, but this time, those personal contacts weren't enough to smooth things out, or even cut through the bureaucratic clutter. All the police could say was that Elenia was in custody. Her bail request had been denied, and they'd been ordered not to allow her visitors. The person behind the order hadn't been named, but everything had come directly from the governor's office. Not that Arinda didn't already know who was behind it.
"Arik Uvis works with Azadi's office,"
Talmor pointed out as he and Arinda left the station.
"Maybe he can help."
"Maybe,"
Arinda said, a twinge of guilt briefly warming the ice that had formed in her soul. In retrospect, she should have told her parents about her last conversation with Uvis. At least they wouldn't have been so utterly blindsided by this cowardly attack.
"I'll go see him after I drop you off."
"Thanks, when I'm okay,"
Talmor said.
"We can go see him together."
"I really think you should go home,"
Arinda persisted. A plan was slowly forming in the back of her mind, the kind that worked best without witnesses present.
"Barkin was going to keep trying for bail. If he gets it, you don't want to be all the way across Capital City when Mother's ready for you to come get her."
"I suppose,"
Talmor conceded.
"You'll let me know what Uvis says, won't you?"
"Absolutely," Arinda promised. "But I'm not expecting anything right away. Try to get some sleep, okay?"
"I'll try."
He eyed her, his eyes narrowing slightly.
"Be careful, Arinda."
"Don't worry,"
Arinda assured him grimly.
"I will."
It was pure good luck that Senator Domus Renking happened to be on Lothal, instead of on the distant world of Coruscant, where he spent most of his time. According to the press releases, he'd come back to his homeworld for a short vacation and some meetings with Governor Azadi and other political and industrial leaders, and was slated to leave in 2 days. Arinda arrived precisely at 9 in the morning, when Ranking's office opened, and gave her name and reason for her visit to the smiling woman at the reception desk. 2 hours later, She was finally ushered inside.
Miss Price,
Rankin greeted her, standing courteously as she came in.
Please sit down.
Thank you, Senator,
Arinda said, passing between the pair of silent guards flanking the doorway and continuing on to the chair in front of Rankin's desk.
Thank you for seeing me.
It was probably inevitable,
Rankin said with a smile, waiting until she had seated herself before resuming his own seat.
I understand your mother, Alania, has been arrested for embezzlement.
Yes, she has, Arinda said. And she's innocent.
Rankin leaned back in his chair.
Tell me more.
Yes, Senator.
Arinda keyed her datapad and tapped for the first file.
First of all, my mother's finances, she said, setting the datapad on the desk and turning it around to face him. You'll see that there isn't a boost in any of her accounts. If she embezzled, the money had to go somewhere.
She could have set up a secret account,
Rankin pointed out.
Possibly even off-world.
Agreed,
Arinda said.
But if she embezzled, the funds, by definition, had to come from Price Mining. I ran everything from the company's side, digging through all the vectors she had access to. There are no indications of missing money, credit, or resources. No virtual transactions either.
That you could find.
I know more about Price Mining's computer operations than my mother does, Arinda said. There's no way she could pull off something that I couldn't track.
Rankin said. I presume you realize how that makes you look.
Yes, and I didn't embezzle either, Arinda said, reaching across the desk and keying for the next file. This is the company's profit data for the past 2 years. You can see there are regular dips and surges over that time period.
Galactic market fluctuations,
Rankin said, nodding.
Happens in every industry. Your point?
You can see a pattern, Arinda said. Dips here, here, and here. If there was embezzlement, it would probably have been time to hit just the right spot to maybe not get noticed.
You say if there was embezzlement,
Rankin said.
I was under the impression that Governor Azadi's office had confirmed there were funds missing.
So I've heard,
Arinda said, bracing herself as she again tapped the datapad. Now came the tricky part.
But it may not be as simple as missing funds. Here's a security video from a party at the company 2 weeks ago, right in the middle of the latest financial dip.
She pointed to a broad-faced being with fuzzy jowls and wide-set eyes dressed in a dark brown tunic.
You see the Lutrillion here at the side?
Yes.
That's Pomi Harchmack,
Arinda said.
She handles the heavy equipment inventory operations. Her account is separate from the main operating fund account. Now, there. See how she slips out of the room right at the height of the party?
Yes,
Rankin said.
Where does that hallway lead?
To the central office cluster,
Arinda said.
Her desk is in there, from which she can access the entire inventory system. Oh, and a fresh order of digging heads had just come in, with the funds slated to go out the next morning. A perfect time for her to act.
Also a perfect time for a drinking partygoer to go to the restroom,
Rankin pointed out.
What makes you think that's not what she's doing?
Because she leaves 3 more times in the next 2 hours and is gone at least 10 minutes each time,
Arinda said.
What does that have to do with anything?
Because that's how financial transactions work here,
Arinda said.
I don't know how it is on Coruscant, but on Lothal, secure fund shifting usually requires 2 or 3 touch points, and the authorization codes sometimes bounce back and forth over an hour or more.
Rankin grunted.
Pretty inefficient.
Extremely inefficient,
Arinda agreed sourly. It was yet another part of Lothal's quaint approach to life, that she found infuriating. But we're stuck with it. The banks and supply houses all have their own ways of doing things, and none of them like turning everything over to computers or droids. Everyone wants to have a personal touch in big transactions.
Yes, that does sound like Lothal,
Rankin conceded. He poised a finger over the datapad.
May I?
Certainly. He tapped the datapad to fast-forward the recording. As far as Arinda could tell, he had no suspicions that what she'd told him was anything but the truth.
And it was, really.
Except that Arinda remembered her mother mentioning earlier that day how Pomi Harchmack had been having digestive problems, which meant all those disappearances almost certainly were to the restroom. Maybe Harchmack was innocent.
Maybe there were no missing funds, and Uvis was simply making a bald-faced play for control.
Or maybe the stomach thing had been a deception, an excuse, and Harchmack was genuinely guilty. Arinda didn't know. She also didn't care. All she cared about was drawing enough suspicion off her mother to persuade Ranking to intervene. Once he did, Harchmack's guilt or innocence was her own problem.
May I make a copy of all this?
Ranking asked.
Actually, I already made you one,
Arinda said, pulling a data card from her pocket and placing it on the desk.
He smiled wryly as he picked it up.
Rather sure of ourselves, are we?
Just the opposite, Arinda said. If I couldn't get you to see me in person, I thought you might at least look at the evidence I'd compiled.
I'm glad I decided to take the time,
Ranking said.
Give me a moment.
He finished watching the security recording, then silently pushed the datapad back across the desk to Arinda and turned to his computer. For the next few minutes, he worked the keys, gazing at the display. Arinda remained where she was, trying without success to read his expression. Finally, he hit one last key and turned back to face her.
Here's the situation,
he said, his voice grave.
First, as matters stand, I can't lift the embezzlement charge.
Arinda stared at him. That wasn't the answer she'd been expecting.
What about Harchmack? I just showed you there's another suspect who's at least as viable as my mother.
No, she's viable, all right,
Ranking agreed.
And I've no doubt she'll be detained as soon as I pass this on to the police. But without proof of your mother's innocence, Governor Azadi isn't going to release her.
Can we at least get her out on bail?
You really don't understand what this is about,
Ranking asked, giving her an odd look.
This is Azadi's attempt to take over Price Mining.
Azadi's or Uvis's?
Does it matter?
Probably not,
Arinda conceded.
That's why I came to you instead of pleading my case to him. I hoped that if I gave you enough ammunition, you could stop him. Now you're telling me you can't?
Ranking raised his eyebrows.
What makes you think I want to stop him?
He asked.
What makes you think I'm not part of his plan?
Arinda pursed her lips. What did make her think that?
Because if you were part of the plot, you wouldn't have told me about it. You'd have kept quiet or encouraged me to make a deal to sell out.
Very good,
Ranking said, favoring her with a small smile.
You're right. There is a certain rivalry between the governor and me. And there is a way I can help your mother. But I don't think you'll like it.
I'm listening.
I can get the charges dropped,
Ranking said.
Sounds good so far, Arinda said. What about the company?
That's the part you won't like,
Ranking said.
You'll have to sign the mine over to the Empire.
Arinda had suspected something like that was coming. Even so, the words were like a punch in the gut.
The Empire.
Ranking held out his hands, palms upward.
You're going to lose the mine, Arinda, he said. Either to Azadi or to the Empire.
because of the Dunium.
Basically, Ranking said. Bear in mind that Coruscant can take it by fiat with no compensation at all. Right now they'd prefer to play nice in this part of the Outer Rim, but that restraint won't last forever. This way, at least you'll get your mother out and new jobs for your family.
Arinda shook her head. I don't think they'd want to work the mine for someone else.
Oh, I wasn't talking about keeping them here,
Ranking assured her.
Not at Price Mining or anywhere else on Lothal. Governor Azadi is a vindictive man, and as long as they're in his jurisdiction, he might be tempted to mess with them out of pure spite. Fortunately, there's a mine I know on Baton that needs an assistant manager and an experienced foreman. I already have an offer.
Arinda smiled tightly. The 2 hours you kept me waiting outside.
Ranking shrugged.
That and other things. Unfortunately, there's no data work position for you at the moment, but the owner says he can put you on inventory until something better opens up.
I see, Arinda said, watching him closely. Lothal was awash with petty politics, and over the years she'd learned how to navigate them. If the same rules applied to the Imperial version, I suppose I could just stay here on Lothal until then.
I wouldn't advise that, Ranking said quickly. Not with Azadi unhappy with you.
Unhappy with me?
Ranking's lip twitched in a small smile.
Unhappy with me, then, he conceded.
He probably wouldn't hesitate to try squeezing me, either,
Arinda said slowly, as if she were just now working it out.
That wouldn't be good for either of us.
Hardly,
Ranking said, a mixture of amusement and resignation on his face.
Let's skip to the last page. What exactly do you want?
I want to go to Coruscant, Arinda said. You must have 100 good assistant positions you can offer. I want one of them.
In exchange for what?
Ranking asked.
Favors have to work both ways.
In exchange for not making trouble when the Empire takes over Price Mining, Arinda said. Maybe you've forgotten what people are like here, but they won't be happy about a bald-faced takeover.
Oh, I remember just fine,
Ranking assured her.
Why do you think I'm taking this approach instead of just letting the Empire move in directly and cut Azadi off at the knees? Lothal's like every other frontier planet in the Outer Rim. Unruly and a potential pain in the rear.
But a new Dunium vein is worth the trouble.
It's worth a lot of trouble.
Ranking took a deep breath, eyeing Arinda closely.
All right. As it happens, I do have a job on Coruscant I can offer you. There's an opening in one of my citizen assistance offices.
What are those?
My job is to represent Lothal's interests on Coruscant,
Ranking said.
That includes citizens visiting or temporarily working there. It turns out that there's a decent-sized contingent of such displaced citizens working in the Coruscant mines.
Arinda's surprise must have shown, because he smiled.
Not real mines, of course. Not like yours,
he said.
These are more like reclamation operations, where centuries' worth of dumped slag, metal shards, and other debris is dug up from around the foundations of old industrial plants. The Lothal contingent is always in flux, so I have an assistance office in the area to help them with housing and general orientation, as well as guiding them through the Coruscant bureaucratic maze.
How many people are we talking about?
About 500 at the moment,
Ranking said.
But there are miners and support personnel from a dozen other Outer Rim worlds working the reclamation projects as well. And that number probably comes to 10,000 or more. I have people who understand bureaucracy, but no one who understands mines and the specific needs and language of miners. I think you'd be a great asset to me.
I'm sure I would, Arinda said. What would my housing and salary be? And when would you want me to leave Lothal?
Housing would be modest, but salary would be far higher than here,
Ranking said, studying her face.
Enough to maintain your current lifestyle, even at Coruscant prices. As to leaving, I could take you there as soon as the agreement with the Empire for price mining is finalized. Unless you'd like to help settle your parents on Baton first, of course.
That would probably be best, Arinda said. Assuming I can persuade them to go along with this plan in the first place.
I hope for their sake that you can,
Ranking warned, his voice going darker.
It's either this, or your mother's next mining job could be on Kessel.
Then I'd better go talk to them.
Arinda stood up and slipped her data pad back into its pouch.
I assume you can get the visitor ban on my mother lifted?
I'll give the order as soon as you're out the door.
Thank you, Arinda said. I'll be in touch.
5 minutes later, she was driving down the roadway, her mind spinning with conflicting thoughts and emotions. So this was it. After years of waiting, after years of knowing it would never happen, she was finally getting off Lothal. Not just off Lothal, but to Coruscant. And all it would cost was her parents' jobs and dignity, and several generations of the Price family legacy. It wasn't as if Ranking was being completely altruistic, either. Part of his goal in accepting Arinda's thinly veiled demand was clearly to split up the family, which would help stifle any legal challenge or local stirring they might decide to mount. But machinations and plots aside, one point stood out clearly. Coruscant. As a child, she'd wanted to see the lights and colors and big buildings of that distant world. In the turmoil of her teenage hopelessness and desperation, the glittering capital had seemed the epitome of the life she so desperately wanted. Now, when all hope was past, she was finally going to get there.
Ranking had his own reasons and agenda.
But then so did Arinda. Because along with the lights and colors and big buildings, Coruscant was first and foremost the center of Imperial political power.
The power that Azadi had used to put her mother in prison. The power Ranking was using to take their mine for the Empire.
The power that Arinda would someday use to take it back. So her parents would accept Ranking's terms. Arinda would see to that. And then she would go to Coruscant and work in Ranking's little assistant's office and be a good girl and a model employee. Right up until the moment when she found a way to take him down.
Chapter 5.
All opponents are not necessarily enemies, but both enemies and opponents carry certain characteristics in common. Both perceive their opposite as an obstacle, or an opportunity, or a threat. Sometimes the threat is personal. Other times, it is a perceived violation of standards or accepted norms of society. In mildest form, the opponent's attacks are verbal. The warrior must choose which of those to stand against and which to ignore. Often that decision is taken from his hands by others. In those cases, lack of discipline may dissuade the opponent from further attacks. More often, though, the opponent finds himself encouraged to continue or intensify the attacks. It is when the attacks become physical that the warrior must make the most dangerous of choices.
Don't you see?
Vanto demanded.
His voice is harsh and strident. His hand gestures are wide and expansive. He is angry and frustrated.
If you keep ignoring these episodes, they're just going to get worse.
How would you have me respond? Thrawn asked.
You need to tell Commandant Dinlark,
Vanto said.
His voice is still harsh, but his gestures are calming. The anger abates, but the frustration remains.
A month in and you've already had run-ins with 4 separate cadets.
3,
Thrawn corrected.
The second incident was unintended.
You only think that because you're not up on core world slang,
Vanto said.
He makes a gesture mimicking that of the supposed insult.
That isn't in any way a mark of respect.
But I have seen similar gestures without such intent.
Not in the core worlds, you haven't.
Vanto sweeps his hand crosswise in front of him, indicating dismissal.
Look, 3 or 4, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you're not being respected, and Dinlark needs to know that.
To what end?
Thrawn asked.
Look.
Vanto pauses, the muscles in his jaw tensing and relaxing as he prepares his statement.
The Emperor himself put you here. Even if no one else knows that, Dinlark does. For his sake, you need to let him know. Because if the Emperor finds out that this has been happening and Dinlark hasn't done anything, there will be trouble.
Commandant Dinlark is in a poor tactical position,
Thrawn said.
If he is told and does nothing, he risks attack by the Emperor. If he hears and acts, he risks attack by the families of the cadets.
So what would a good tactician do?
Ideally, he would withdraw to a better position or a different time, Thrawn said. In this case, he can do neither. Vanto looks toward the window. His facial heat is fading. He grows more deeply in understanding of the situation.
So what you're saying is that we're stuck?
Only for 2 more months, Thrawn said. We then graduate and leave this place.
And you finally get to put on that lieutenant's rank plaque, Vanto said.
He returns his gaze and points to the pocket where the plaque is customarily concealed. His facial and throat muscles again tighten briefly. His frustration increases.
Are you disturbed by that? Disturbed by what? Vanto asked.
His voice deepens and grows more harsh. Frustration, but also resentment.
That you're getting through 4 years of academy training in 3 months, and then jumping a rank on everyone else on top of it?
Have you forgotten I have already passed through many years of military experience? Vanto again turns his face away.
I know that. I just sometimes forget that you... I'm sorry I even brought it up.
His face smooths out as the resentment fades. His hands open and close briefly with embarrassment.
I understand, Thrawn said.
Do not be concerned. The incidents will stop when the offenders are emboldened enough to push their actions too far. Vanto's eyes narrow. He is surprised now, with growing disbelief and suspicion.
Are you saying you want them to cross the line?
I believe the lack of response to verbal attacks makes it inevitable, Thrawn said. Such actions would put them in position for official discipline. Would it not?
Probably.
Vanto holds his hands in front of him in a gesture of confusion.
But didn't you just...
Hold it. I've got a call.
He pulled out his comlink.
Cadet Vanto.
For a minute, he listened in silence.
The voice is human. The words indistinguishable. Vanto's facial muscles tighten, and his facial heat increases. He is first surprised by what he hears, then wary, then suspicious.
Sure, sounds like fun, Vanto said.
His voice is guarded, but holds none of the weariness revealed in his expression.
We'll be there.
He closed down the comlink.
Well, you may just have gotten your wish, he said. We've been invited to the metallurgy lab tonight to play cards with Spank Orbar and Rosita Turoy, while they run some corrosion tests on one of their alloy boards.
Are we permitted in the metallurgy lab?
Thrawn asked.
Not unless we have a project we're working on, Vanto said.
His lips compressed briefly. His suspicions changed to certainty.
Which we don't.
What if we are invited guests of those with such projects?
No such thing, Vanto said. Not in the big labs. If some wandering instructor or officer catches us, they will not be happy. And if the card game includes betting, it'll go even worse. Gambling for credits is strictly forbidden.
That assures they will not attempt such a trap.
No? Why not?
Because if we are charged with gambling, they will be also, Thrawn said.
Vanto shook his head.
You still don't get how it works, do you?
His facial heat increases. His muscle tension also increases. Once again, he shows frustration.
Orbar's family is from here on Coruscant. Worse, they're connected to the planet Senator. He could probably pull anything short of straight-up murder without getting kicked out.
Then we will simply refuse any offers to gamble. Vanto exhales noisily.
You're going to go, aren't you?
His voice is calmer, indicating unwilling acceptance.
We were invited, Thrawn reminded him. You may stay here if you wish. Oh, I wish all right, Vanto said. But I don't think letting you wander around alone is what the Emperor had in mind when he put me here. Might as well find out what Orbar has planned.
His head turns a few degrees to the side. He is curious, or perhaps perplexed.
Is this what Chiss do? See a trap and just walk into it? Because that's not how the stories say you operate.
You would be wise to tread carefully around such stories, Thrawn said. Some have been distorted to the point where no truth remains. Some speak only of victories and are silent about defeats. Some have been deliberately crafted to leave false impressions in the hearer.
And which one is this?
Sometimes walking into a trap is the best strategy, Thrawn said. There are few traps that cannot be turned against their designers. What card game did he suggest?
It's called Highland Challenge, Vanto said.
Resigned acceptance.
Come on, I think there's a deck in the lounge. I'll teach you how to play.
I suppose you're wondering,
Orbar said, as he dealt out the first hand,
why we asked you two here tonight.
You said it was to play cards,
Eli said, watching him closely. Both Orbar and Turoy were playing it cool, getting Eli and Thrawn at the door, making a big fuss of setting up their corrosion test, then pulling four chairs up to one of the lab tables and bringing out the cards. But the courtesy and friendliness weren't real. Maybe Thrawn still couldn't pick up the subtleties of human expressions, but Eli could. He'd been on the receiving end of his own set of sly smiles and whispered comments since the day they'd arrived, and he'd developed a fine-tuned sense of when he was about to be hit with a joke, trick, or insult. And Orbar and Turoy were definitely winding up for one of the three. Or something worse. At least it wasn't the gambling thing Eli had worried about. Turoy had put up a small fuss when Eli told her that neither he nor Thrawn could afford the extra credits to bet on their game, and she and Orbar had accepted the condition with rolled eyes and thinly veiled scorn. But the fuss hadn't been big enough, and they'd given in too easily. Something else was in the works, he grimaced.
walking into an unknown trap. Was this really how Chiss did things?
Oh, sure. The game was part of it,
Orvar said, finishing the deal and picking up his cards.
Corrosion tests are boring, and you get tired of two-handed games.
He shifted his gaze to Thrawn.
But mostly, I wanted to pick your friend's brain.
On what subject?
Thrawn asked, his glowing red eyes narrowing slightly, as he carefully fanned his cards the way Eli had shown him.
Tactics and strategy, Orbar said. I'm having some trouble in a couple of my battle simulation classes, and I figured with all your military experience...
At least that's what we've been told,
Turoy put in with a smile. She was smiling way too much tonight.
Right,
Orbar said.
We figured you might be able to help.
I'm happy to share my experience,
Thrawn said.
Have you a specific question?
I'm interested in the idea of traps,
Orbar said, his voice way too casual.
Take these cards. If I'm holding a King's Lane, there's no way any of you can beat me. But you won't know that until it's too late. How would you prepare for that kind of situation?
One would first study the probabilities,
Thrawn said.
A King's Lane is indeed unbeatable, but recall that there are three equivalent runs in the deck. Any of them would stagger yours and lead to mutual deadlock.
Turoy snorted.
You have any idea what the odds are against getting two King's Lanes in the same deal?
She asked.
The odds for having two are similar to the odds for having one,
Thrawn pointed out.
But as you say, such runs are rare. More likely you hold a Prince's Lane at best, or a Cube or Triad. In that event, what you described as a trap would more likely be termed simply a battle. His eyes glittered. Or a bluff.
Okay, but you're avoiding the question,
Orbar said.
I asked what you'd do if I had a King's Lane. I didn't ask for a dissertation on game theory.
Let us assume you have the cards you suggest,
Thrawn said.
As I said earlier, even in that case, your chance of success also depends upon which cards I hold.
He lifted his fanned cards slightly.
Knowledge that you do not have.
The premise is that my hand is unbeatable.
There is no such hand,
Thrawn said flatly.
As I suggested earlier, I might have a King's Lane of my own. In that case, a challenge would mean mutual destruction. Your better option would be to avoid my hand and deliver your challenge to a different player.
Orbar flicked a glance at Eli.
That assumes there's another target worth going after.
True,
Thrawn said.
But mutual destruction is never the preferred option.
He gestured around the table.
You have not yet made your challenge. It is not too late to choose another.
But none would be more satisfying,
Orbar said, smiling tightly.
As you wish,
Thrawn said, shrugging.
A moment, if you will.
He set his cards face down on the table and slipped his hand into his tunic and drew it out, holding his lieutenant's insignia plaque. He fastened it into position on his upper left tunic and picked up his cards again.
I believe you are about to make a challenge.
Eli looked at Orbar and Turoy. Both cadets were staring at the insignia plaque. Their eyes widened, their mouths drooping open. Orbar threw a quick look at Turoy, got a completely unsmiling glance back from her.
What's going on here?
A hard voice called from behind Thrawn. Eli jerked his head around. One of the instructors stood in the lab doorway, his fists on his hips, his expression thunderous as he glared at the cadets around the table.
"I assume you all have authorization to be in here,"
he growled, striding toward the table.
"Cadets Orbar and Turoy are running a test, sir,"
Thrawn said, standing up and turning to face the instructor. The other man came to an abrupt halt, his own eyes widening. Enough reaction, Eli thought darkly, to show he'd been in on Orbar's scheme.
"Lieutenant,"
he breathed.
"I... What about him?"
he asked, nodding toward Eli.
"Cadet Vanto is my translator," Thrawn said calmly. "Where I go, he must necessarily accompany me."
The instructor's lip twitched.
"I see. I... Very well, Lieutenant. Carry on."
He spun on his heel and beat a hasty retreat. Thrawn watched him go. Then very deliberately, he turned back to the table and gazed down upon the others.
"There is no guaranteed winning hand, Cadet Orbar," he said quietly. "I suggest you not forget that. Cadet Vanto, I believe we are finished here. Good evening, cadets."
A minute later, he and Eli were back out in the reflected light of the planet-wide city surrounding them, walking along the path leading toward Barracks 2.
"Well, that was fun,"
Eli commented, wincing at the slight shaking in his voice. Would he never get used to confrontations?
"So you knew he was going to pull that?"
"You yourself suggested his tactic this afternoon," Thrawn reminded him. "The timing was the only challenge."
"The timing?"
"If I had brought out my insignia plaque too soon, he might have been able to warn off his confederate," Thrawn said. "If I had waited until after the instructor's appearance, he could have disciplined me for being improperly uniformed."
"Or could have challenged your right to wear it," Eli pointed out. "You've never worn it before."
"Because I am both officer and cadet," Thrawn said. "It is a unique situation, which leads to unique opportunities." He smiled slightly. "As well as confusion and uncertainties among our opponents. What did you learn tonight?"
Eli wrinkled his nose. That Orbar and Turoy were jerks to be avoided in the future? True enough, but probably not what Thrawn was going for.
"Anticipate your enemy," he said. "Figure out what he's doing, and try to stay a step ahead of him."
"A step ahead, or to the side," Thrawn said, nodding. "When an attack comes, it is usually best to be out of the target zone if possible, thus permitting the energy of the assault to be dissipated elsewhere."
"Yes, I can see how that could be handy," Eli said dryly. "Though I guess you can't always
And without warning, Thrawn put his hand on Eli's shoulder and gave him a violent shove to the side. Eli's comment ended in a startled squeak as his legs hit the knee-high hedge bordering the walkway, the impact and his momentum sending him sprawling over the barrier onto the decorative crushed stone strip on the other side. The squeak turned into a grunt as his arms and shoulder took the brunt of the impact. He shoved himself back up to a sitting position, wincing as the gravel dug into his palms. "What the hell?" He stiffened. Three hooded men had suddenly appeared, surrounding Thrawn. And as Eli stared in disbelief, they moved in for the kill. For that first stretched-out second, Eli's mind refused to believe it. Things like this didn't happen on the Royal Imperial Academy grounds. They just didn't. But it was happening, right in front of him. The first mad charge seemed to have hit a little off center, probably because Thrawn's action in shoving Eli over the hedge had similarly pushed the Chiss a meter in the opposite direction. But the assailants were quick. They were back on track now, and were converging on the Chiss. And as Eli watched in disbelief and horror, they attacked. The standard academy curriculum included a unit on unarmed combat. Unfortunately, with Ron's studies focused exclusively on technology and Navy protocol, he hadn't been given any time in the combat dojo. And it showed. He was doing his best to fend off his attackers, but his defense consisted mainly of trying to push them away, ducking away from their attacks, dodging so that they couldn't all come at him at once, and trying to protect his face and torso. But it wasn't enough. Defense alone was never enough. He needed to start adding in a few counterattacks to make an effort to reduce the odds against him. Right now, he was in a battle of attrition, and no matter how much stamina he had, he would almost certainly run out of strength before his attackers did. And then, unbidden, a thought slipped in at the edge of Eli's mind. This could be the end of all his problems. It was a horrible thought, a gruesome thought. And yet, it was startlingly compelling. If Thrawn was so badly injured that he couldn't complete his training, he would have no choice but to drop out. The Emperor's grand experiment, whatever he'd hoped to accomplish by bringing the Chiss into the Navy, would have failed. There would be nothing left to do but take Thrawn back to his exile planet and leave him there. And Eli would be free. The Strikefast was long gone, of course. But he could grab a transport to Myanmar, paying for it out of his own pocket if he had to, and be back on track at the Academy there within a week. Surely Commandant Dean Lark wouldn't want him to stay at Royal Imperial once Thrawn was gone, any more than Eli himself wanted it. Back on Myanmar, back in his proper career path, back to his life. One of the attackers got in a solid punch to Thrawn's lower torso, sending the Chiss down to one knee. And a flood of shame abruptly flowed over Eli's soul. What the hell was he thinking? Hey! He shouted, pushing himself up into a crouch. As he did so, he dug his fingers into the crushed stone beneath him, ignoring the flickers of pain as the sharp edges dug into his skin. Hey, you! Bright Eyes! Two of the three turned to face him. And with all his strength, Eli hurled two handfuls of gravel straight at their faces. He hadn't really expected it to work, but it did. Both attackers howled in pain, belatedly throwing up their hands against the hail of stone. Eli leaned down and dug his hands into the ground again, wondering if he could get another volley into the air before they could recover and respond. Because if he couldn't, if they jumped the hedge and got to him first, he was in serious trouble. Thrawn was still down on one knee, unable to help, and 2-1 odds would be more than enough to take Eli down. Too late. It occurred to him that the assailants had learned their tactics lessons all too well, splitting the enemy force in two parts and demolishing them one at a time was a classic approach to warfare. They'd successfully focused their efforts on Thrawn, and now they were going to do the same to Eli. Only they'd miscalculated. Even as the two attackers started toward Eli, the helpless, all but demolished Thrawn leaned toward the man standing over him and slammed his forearm with muscle-paralyzing force into the man's thigh. The man gasped a startled curse, nearly falling as he clutched at his injured leg. His two friends spun back to him, their drive toward Eli wavering as their focus was suddenly split between their two targets. Eli cocked his arms for his next salvo of gravel.
Hey!
Someone shouted from nearby. Eli turned to look. Five cadets had emerged from one of the buildings and were racing toward the fight. That was enough for the attackers. They turned and hurried away into the night. The man Thrawn had hit in the leg, supported on either side by his two companions.
Are you all right?
Eli blinked away the sudden sweat trickling into his eyes, his body shaking with aftershock. Was it over?
I'm fine, he told Thrawn, climbing unsteadily over the hedge.
Strangely enough, his voice wasn't trembling at all.
You?
My